Today, what I want to talk about is I want to talk about suffering. I want to talk about our engagement with suffering. I want to talk about how the idolatry of whiteness and white supremacy ultimately has this function of numbing our suffering. We will know that we are worshiping idols when we ask them to distract us from our experience of suffering. Now, the Hebrews are in the wilderness. They're on their way to the promised land, but they haven't gotten there yet. And here they are without their leader, who was their only connection to God, or so they thought. So here they are in the wilderness without their God. And they're, I like to use the term spiraling out. You know that time when you have a thought, and that thought leads to another thought, and that thought increases your fear, and your fear adds more thoughts, and you just start losing it? Right? Like the ground underneath you just starts sliding out from underneath you, and you get more and more anxious and more upset and more just like, ah! And you need something to interrupt it. You need something to break you out of spiraling out. Well, that's what they're trying to do. They're trying to get a hold of something concrete in this place of total ambiguity. They want something that will tell them that they're okay, that God is somehow still with them. And so they make something, an idol who will make them okay, who will tell them that they're okay. But instead of actually addressing this issue that brought them to spiraling out, instead of naming the anxiety and the fear and the frustration, the feeling of hopelessness, the feeling of being abandoned, they decide, well, let's just party instead, right? We'll get up early in the morning and we'll do our obligatory worshiping stuff, and then we'll just get crazy because that'll help me not think about the fact that I'm terrified. That'll help me not think about the fact that I feel abandoned. That'll help me not think about the fact that I'm completely powerless. Let's just get distracted. There's a feeling there, and I don't like it, so I'm going to avoid it at all costs, right? They want to feel good over actually feeling anything. We know about this in the modern time. Why do you think there's such an epidemic of drug use in this country? Some will argue that the homelessness crisis is caused by massive drug use. I will argue that it is exactly the opposite, that the experience of alienation from community, the experience of constant insecurity, what are you supposed to do with that? And especially when the society seems to tell you that it doesn't really matter, that it doesn't seem like there's any real movement to address this. Well, let's just numb out, right? So what the people do is they commit to distracting themselves rather than feeling their feelings. We will know when we are worshiping idols when we ask them repeatedly, near constantly, to distract us from our suffering. And this is where Isaiah comes in. Isaiah is speaking to the people right on the cusp of the fall of the northern kingdom. Remember, the northern kingdom split from the southern kingdom. They established their own king. They established their own center of worship. They established their own everything, their own economy, their own structure. And Isaiah is looking at them and he's saying, yeah, look at you. Your land is full of gold and silver, and there's no end to your treasure. Your land is full of horses, and there is no end to your chariots. You've got enough stuff, and you've got enough strength to protect all your stuff. You've got enough stuff to distract you from the fact that you have cut yourself off from the rest of your people. You've got enough stuff to distract you from the fact that you got here because God brought you into this land and promised it for all 12 tribes of Israel. But you've now separated yourself from your people and decided that you're going to become your own people with your own story and your new narrative. And they're proud of their accomplishment. They've started a new kingdom. How cool is that? We've got our own thing now. Look at us. Aren't we great? But of course, to lean into that narrative that we did it ourselves, we created this, this is ours, is to forget who? God, the ground of all being, the one that makes all these things possible, the one that gives you the strength to do all of the things, that gives you the capacity to hold the knowledge, right? All the things that you do of your own accord, on some level, are still predicated on the gifts of God. So in order to say that I am a self-made man and we are a self-made country and this is ours, is ultimately to forget the Lord our God, is ultimately to be committed to the work of our own hands, to worship an idol that we create. Next time you hear somebody say those words, remember that what they're saying is that they've come to believe and trust in the idol that they worship. They've bought into a success narrative. And the primary purpose of that success narrative is to justify not thinking about how they just cut themselves off from the rest of their people. Because this is a good thing. We did this. This is us. Well, it's most of us. So Isaiah says, you know what's going to happen? At some point, the fullness of God is going to be revealed. And how's that going to feel? It's going to feel pretty terrible. You're going to feel the terror of the Lord in the face of the majesty of God. The people will cower in fear. Why? Is God a big stick wielder? Is God's ultimate desire to punish us for all the things that we do wrong? No. What is God's ultimate desire for us? Love us into rightness. So if we're terrified of the presence of God, perhaps it's because our will is at odds with God's will. That perhaps the reason that we should be terrified is actually because where we're going is the wrong direction. And that perhaps the experience of the terror of the Lord is really that thing that convicts us that we missed the boat. But if we numb out, we won't know that. If we numb out, what we will do is we will absolutely stop listening to God. We will absolutely stop prioritizing knowing God's will. But we have to be strong enough to handle the discomfort that comes from knowing. But the reality is we already know. Come on now, you think the Northern Kingdom doesn't know in the back of their mind on some level that everything they're doing has been predicated upon them being cut off from Jerusalem, being cut off from the rest of their kin? You don't think they know that every time they go to worship, every time they pay taxes to their new king, every time they talk about their new wealth, their new structure, their new system? Underneath that, you don't think that there's a subtle or possibly just subconscious knowing that this is all based in the wrong way of being? Of course they know it. They just don't want to bring it into consciousness. How many of you have heard the term cognitive dissonance before? Right? Human beings are amazing at figuring out ways to not actually experience cognitive dissonance. We can know that two things are not true, but when we know them at the same time, it upsets us. It causes us to tremble and be frustrated and anxious. And so what do? We figure out how to not think about both of them at the same time. We put one in a box over here. This is historical. This happened a long time ago. But this is in the now, and I live in the now because I'm not going to be burdened by the past, right? I'm a self-made man. I don't want cognitive dissonance, i.e. the presence of God agitating my thoughts. So they justify. The Northern Kingdom justifies, and they lean into their pride. They lean into their creation to stay distracted. We will know we are worshiping idols when we ask them constantly and regularly to distract us from our suffering. I was at the Hiawatha Summer Concert Series on Thursday, and I decided to say before the concert started, I'd just like to acknowledge that we are standing on unceded Duwamish land. And I felt the discomfort in the almost exclusively white gathering of young families when I said it. And I left only a couple seconds of silence before I moved on, but I could feel it like a wave wash up against my body. And I was half expecting someone to come up to me afterwards and say, "You know, that was unnecessary. Why did you need to do that at the beginning of a time when I was trying to have fun with my kids?" No one did, but I was expecting it. I was steeling myself for figuring out how was I going to respond to that statement. I mean, how many of us are actually comfortable talking about the legacy and history of white supremacy in this country? How many of us can actually stand to stay in a conversation where all we're doing is naming the historical facts of how this country was established? I would argue probably very few of us. It's very hard. Because why? Because it activates the cognitive dissonance that says, if that happened and it mattered, it probably still matters. But I put that in a history box. And so we wrestle and we justify and we say, well, that wasn't me, right? I'm here now. I don't even know anything about my ancestors, so I can't say whether I'm complicit in that or not. How many of you even know the names of people beyond your grandparents' generation? A number of you. That's amazing. That's amazing. Because most of the white folks that I have talked to do not know anything about their ancestry beyond their own grandparents, including my own family. I asked my parents about it the other day, and they don't know anything about their families beyond their grandparents' generation. What I want to offer, though, in thinking about this is, you know, if we can't talk about this stuff, what we can't talk about is the way that it harms us. My Bible study group this morning read a piece of work by Paul Cavell about the harms of white supremacy to white people. And it's a checklist of all of these ways that the presence of white supremacy, the history of white supremacy in the United States, harms white people today. And I want you to just think about how much you second-guess yourself as a white person when you're entering into relationship with people of color. Like, for me, when I see somebody, I'm like, metacognitive about it. Like, oh, do I acknowledge them? Should I acknowledge them? Am I acknowledging them enough? Am I doing it too much? Am I being awkward? Like, this worry about, is it right or not? That anxiety that I don't feel interacting with white folks. Did I look scared? Oh, man, I don't know if I look scared. Now do I look worried? Oh, my God, I need to check my face, right? But if we can't name that we feel those feelings, then we can't lament the way that those feelings harm us, right? If we can't admit that we have those thoughts and feelings, then we can't actually acknowledge that we suffer by their existence. See, what happens in the narrative about whiteness and white supremacy is that all the harm is on people of color and all the benefit is on white people. And so then if we feel any harm, we're distracting from the issue. But the reality is that white supremacy harms everybody. It poisons all of our relationships. But we can't talk about that unless we can actually admit and talk about the ways that we have participated in it. The ways that we feel it, the ways that it's become part of our bodies, the ways that it messes up our relationships because it's in us, right? But we can't have the conversation about harm, which means ultimately we can't invite God in to heal the harm if we can't admit the presence. Right? And we can't admit the presence because it says something about who we are. And especially as Christians, I really want to say as Christians, I think this is even harder. Because if you're a baptized Christian, the idea of baptism, I will argue, is about there's a transformation. There was me, and then there's the new me. There's the me who's committed to the way of Christ. There's me who's committed to the new life that I can find. If you're into the language, there's the being washed, right? There's supposed to be a before and an after. And if I'm on the after side, well, I'm supposed to be free from sin, right? Wrong. That doesn't make any sense. Did you know that St. Augustine, this like early church father, he wrote all kinds of stuff, including the Confessions. He was kind of foundational in the creation of the original sin kind of dogma. He waited until he was almost dead before he got baptized because he was sure he was going to screw it up. He knew enough about people that he was like, nah, I got to wait till I can't really talk, can't really move, I ain't going nowhere. Get baptized real quick, and then it better be over soon, because I'll have a thought or a feeling afterwards, and I'll screw this whole thing up. What a messed up understanding of the faith, right? That's a church father. That's a man who people have quoted for centuries to think about Christianity, and that was still his thinking. But such is the desire to avoid the suffering. Such is a desire to be separate from it. We can ignore our suffering if we refuse to admit that these things exist inside of us. That's the only way we can get around it. We will know that we are worshiping idols when we ask them consistently and repeatedly to distract us from our suffering. But I'll argue that our suffering is what reveals God's desire for us. That cognitive dissonance is that place where our will encounters God's will. And our disquiet, our discomfort, our frustration, our fear, our anxiety is a revelation to us. There's another church father, Irenaeus, who talked about feelings, and he said, feelings point you to your values. Feelings in and of themselves, you got to be careful leaning into your feelings because you can make all kinds of heinous decisions when you're in your feelings, right? But having your feelings, feeling your feelings is absolutely important because it shows you what your values are. They reveal to you what really matters to you by what really upsets you, by what disquiets you. And perhaps knowing that helps you know that maybe your values aren't in the right place. Maybe this thing that's upsetting you shouldn't be upsetting you, but if you don't let yourself feel upset, then you won't get a check-in about where your values are located. I will argue that our upsetness, our anxiety, our fear, our frustration about talking about this, about white supremacy, helps us know who God is and what God wants. Because we know that there's something wrong. We know there's something wrong about how we feel. But if we don't feel it, we can't connect with where it is rooted within us. So there's an older woman that I met with last week, and we were talking about this stuff. And she says, you know, I'm from another country, and I don't know what you're talking about all this racism stuff. I mean, I've lived here for like 20, 30 years, but like, you know, we didn't have that where I came from. And then she told this story. It was so interesting. She told this story where she had said the same thing to somebody else, and they started asking her a bunch of questions. Well, how do you feel about this? Well, how do you feel about that? And she felt very good that she answered every question in a non-racist way until they got to the final question. And the final question was, would you marry a black man? She got all flushed. She was like, I had to say no. I had to say that I wouldn't. And then she looked me dead in the face, this very serious expression, and said, "Does that make me a racist?" And I felt so bad for her in that moment. I felt so bad for her in that moment because for her, admitting that she had that thought and feeling meant that there was something wrong with her, that she was broken somehow, that she was beyond repair. And she understood herself to be a good person, and she had always intentionally included people and always intentionally connected with people, always tried to be kind and generous and polite and courteous, had hired folks in her restaurant who were people of color. But once she named that place that was incongruous, she was so caught up in her fear and her guilt and her shame that she was worried that maybe her baptism was not enough, that maybe the love of God wasn't enough, because maybe she's racist and she's too old to change. And I thought, man, white supremacy does a good job on us, because then we're all worried about, well, what does this mean about me? And then we're distracted, and then we're defensive, and then we don't talk about the suffering that comes from the way that we think, the suffering that comes from having internalized this idolatry within us. And if we don't talk about the suffering, then we don't talk about God's presence. This is the thing, that the revelation of God will do two things for us at the same time. It will expose the idolatry within us. It will expose the ways that our hearts have brought, as Ezekiel said last week, have brought these idols inside of us. They become a part of us. They become part of our narrative. They're part of our history, the history that we don't tell, the things we don't talk about. The encounter with God will reveal that they're there, and at the same time, it will reveal all the lost possibilities that that idol prevented. Because I thought about this woman, I thought, how many times was there a beautiful young black man that could have been a partner to you? How many times was there someone that you could have connected to, but somewhere deep down inside of you, there was a fear, a learned fear, that kept you just a little bit distant? How many relationships didn't happen? And can we grieve that? Can we grieve the separation? Can we grieve the fact, at least can I grieve the fact, that the vast majority of my relationships are with white folks? That my assumption about this neighborhood is that it's a white neighborhood. But I'll tell you, when I was coming back from the Hiawatha concert series on Thursday, there were a lot of people of color around this neighborhood, going in and out of the bars and restaurants, walking down the street, getting coffee. And I thought, man, how have I been conditioned to see the world? And can I lament that? When we delivered those Thanksgiving baskets, there is a black Muslim family, I think they're from either Eritrea or Ethiopia, that lives like three blocks from here. But is there something that is causing me to not see the world the way it is? And can I lament that? We will only know the true losses that we've encountered. We will only know the true disabling of our ability to see the world if we can truly repent of what has been inside of us, what is inside of us. So I will say to you that we will know that we are worshiping the Lord Almighty when we can allow our own suffering to be united with God's suffering. See, we often, I think, at least I, want to fix stuff, right? When I start feeling uncomfortable, that cognitive dissonance, I want to fix it. I want to solve it. I want to change it. I want it done. Yesterday, I didn't want to feel it at all, so I wish that I would have fixed it earlier, but now I have to fix it right now. I have to react to this thing. But what is that desire ultimately about? It's about not feeling the suffering, right? But we know that it is our desire to control that separates us from God, because our desire to control is what distracts us from letting God actually be in charge. And our desire control often leads us in these directions where we just get more cognitive dissonance, where our will is even more estranged from God's will. And there's one thing I've learned from an encounter with recovery communities, it's this. Once you finally feel incapable of solving the problem on your own, once you finally feel totally stuck, once you finally admit that you cannot do it on your own, that's when the power of God will be known to you. But as long as you can do it on your own, as long as you're the northern kingdom building your own cities and your own wealth and your own power and your own might and forgetting your history, then God is just kind of there. Well, over there. And like, you'll wave every once in a while and you're asked for something, but you don't really need God because you're on it. But that second that you're not on it, that you're not capable, you're not powerful enough, you're not strong enough, you can't make it happen yourself, that's when the reality of God's power becomes known. But Isaiah says we have to let ourselves be humbled first. For all the mighty things will appear to be powerful, and the revelation of the truth of God will bring all of those things low. But I would argue that as white people, if we can figure out how to feel the suffering that's caused by the endemic white supremacy in our society, in our hearts, if we can get in touch with it and feel that suffering and not try to fix it or change it or just become not racist, if we can just feel it, what will happen is our suffering will find a way to unite itself with the suffering that God feels about the presence of white supremacy and anti-black racism and anti-immigrant racism, the idolatry of whiteness that God mourns and laments. If we can feel it long enough and not move straight to fix it, it will knit itself into the suffering of God, and we will see beyond our own fear of being, you know, oh my God, does that make me racist? Does that make me unworthy? Does that exclude me from the beloved community? We'll say, no, I suffer. I'm broken in this. And God is exceptionally more brokenhearted about it than I am. But our sufferings could be united. And then our wills will be united. Because I won't just be suffering about what it means to my own reputation, what it means to my own identity to admit that I have racist thoughts and feelings. It'll be about what does it mean to my community? What does it mean to the world that I live in, that we've got this inside of us? We have to be people who are repentant. And this should be good news. Somebody told me last week that my sermon was a total downer. And they felt like there wasn't any good news in that sermon last week, Pastor. It was all a big bummer, man. And I thought, well, yeah, I mean, this sucks, right? Like, this is horrible. And we can talk about it in church in a way that we can't talk about it in the political arena, right? If you admit this on stage in a debate, whoa, you're torn up, right? You're not good enough already. You can't represent the people. But in church, we all know that none of us is getting out of this one totally pure, right? None of us is getting out of this one unblemished or perfect. There is not such a thing. And to believe in such a thing is to believe in idolatry, that somehow the idol can just wash us completely clean and we can be perfect and porcelain and pure and good enough. There is no such thing. This is the blessing of talking about this in church. This is the gift of God, is that we can name this stuff and it doesn't stick to us. It's a suffering that we experience because who are you? And what does that mean about you? It means you are beloved and worthy, that you are loved unconditionally. And so if we can just feel it, then we can separate it from ourselves and we can say, you know who I am? I'm a beloved child of God. And you know who else is a beloved child of God? Every other human person. And this suffering is part of God's suffering. So how are we as family going to respond to the suffering that empire brings upon us? Because remember, racism is a product of empire thinking. Somebody left this in front of the church. This is a little bronze crucified Jesus. And there's often never any of these in Protestant churches. Our crosses don't have dead Jesus on them. But I've been leaving it on my desk to remember that it is in the facing of the reality of suffering. It is in the facing of the reality of what empire does to people that preach love and justice and mercy that can call us forward and say, this is wrong. This death was wrong. This suffering that I feel, the existence of white supremacy in my own body is wrong and it is against God. And if I connect with it, if I know it, if I feel it, and I don't let it tell me that there's something wrong with me, but instead say there's something wrong with this system. There's something wrong with the influence of empire in my life and my heart that has transformed me to be afraid. Then we can unite with the Lord. In Luke 14:37, Jesus says, none of you can be my disciples unless you're willing to take up your cross and follow me. As white people in the United States of America, this is our cross. This is the tool that empire uses to divide us and destroy us and to keep us focused on ourselves instead of we, the people. So let us not let them win. In these tumultuous days so full of hope and strife, may we bear witness to the way, O goal and source of life. Go forth from this place knowing that that suffering, that encounter with cognitive dissonance is an invitation from God to be in better alignment with the Lord. And you are always at every moment welcome back in. We are in this together, people. Go forth to do justice, to love mercy, and walk humbly with that God who is leading us still. Amen.